So I'd like to talk tonight about what happens when the hindrances no longer hinder. Subtitle: Resting as What Is. It's an obstacle course up here. Whoa, it's a lot of stuff. Can't hear me?
No, I can hear, but the light is blinding me.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
It's blinding me too. Blinded by the light. How's that, Joanne?
Thank you.
Better?
Yeah.
Anybody else blinded? I love this place for a lot of reasons. One is that I turn the lights up for the talk and you turn them down. That's not the place, that's you. But the place is where the lights are that I'm talking about. So resting as what is, what happens when the hindrances no longer hinder? Let's start with just a little piece from David White, the poet David White. If you don't know David White, he's a wonderful poet. He's really quite a human being. And seems to be, deepening in this tremendous gift with language, and travels all over the world. And he's done some very interesting things, and he's got a lot of stuff out there, a lot of stuff. It's really, really good. So here's one piece from David. He says, "To come to ground is to find a home in circumstances and in the very physical body we inhabit in the midst of those circumstances. And above all, to face the truth, no matter how difficult that truth may be. To come to ground is to begin the courageous conversation, to step into difficulty, and by taking that first step, begin the movement through all difficulties. To find the support and foundation that has been beneath our feet all along. A place to step into, a place on which to stand, and a place from which we can step." I think you could apply that to the sitting just as well. And why not add the standing? And why not add the lying down? Why not add all the postures to that? So just about a year ago, a dear friend of mine, long-term dear friend of mine that I hardly ever see in face-to-face flesh. His son has three children. His oldest son, 41 years old, Micah. Beautiful, beautiful young man, artist, really creative. Just a beautiful, beautiful being. He died of stomach cancer, which had metastasized to his liver. He had been sick in some way or other in the intestines pretty much his whole life. So I guess in some ways, my friend Stephen and his wife were not that surprised that it went this direction. But there's another story inside what I'm saying. Probably multiple stories. And you may know the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the wonderful work that she did with the dying process so long ago. She nailed some things that happened. When people are facing death, whether it's their own or the death of someone that matters to them, significant others typically, the first stage is often denial. The second stage is often anger. The third stage is often bargaining. The fourth stage is often depression. And the fifth stage is acceptance. Now, I was in conversation with Stephen on a number of occasions on the phone. That's how we meet these days, on the phone. That's how it's happening. After Micah had passed, and Stephen gave a teaching. He gave a very beautiful teaching. The teaching was so powerful, I couldn't remember it. It just touched me. It went right into a place, and I couldn't recall. And so I contacted him again, and I asked him. He said, "I can go one better than to say it to you again." He goes, "I've written an article. And those pieces that you're unable to recall from my sharing, they're right there in the article. Would you like that?" I said, "Sure." And then I got to read his article, and then I said, "Make sure you publish this as widely as possible, okay?" He said, "I'll try." This is what we can do for friends. You encourage your friend, and your friend encourages you. This is what this guy does for me. Sometimes he doesn't just encourage me, he just tells me what to do. This is what you need to do. And so I figured after he was telling me what to do for a while, I could do it with him. Okay, I'm going to tell him what to do. And this is what friends can do for one another. So here's a teaching from Stephen Schatz. What he did, watch this now. Watch how this happened. It's really, really cool. He completely opened to what Zorba the Greek would call the whole catastrophe. He opened to the pending loss. He opened to the wholeness of the loss. And he opened to what came after the loss. Letting the whole range of feelings be what they were, not to soothe himself or provide emotional band-aids, not to change the feelings in any way, but rather to stay with them and follow their truth wherever it led. Now that part I remember, really was listening to him when he shared that part. That part went right in and I got that. And then he went to the part that I couldn't remember. I had to go back and get from him again from the article. He said when he allowed himself to open and experience the loss of his son, these are what he called the four knowings that came. And they came beautifully and clearly, not as thoughts, he said, but as direct realizations. They came as insights. Number one, your job is not to heal Micah. Number two, your job is not to wish that it was you who was dying instead of Micah, because you are old and he is young. Number three, your job is not to try to take Micah's destiny away from him. And then number four, your job is to love Micah. Three don'ts, one do. What we don't recognize until we do is that awareness is love. our first step in fully attending without interfering or toggling to have what's happening be even in the smallest of ways different, to truly open, receive what comes in a way, is the beginning, middle, and end of the path. I used to truly believe that my family of origin was healthy, wholesome, and I was pretty darn lucky to be a member of the family. Little did I know that through the effects of things like meditation, psychotherapy, and simply being around people in the world, opened the story in a much broader and clearer way. And I'll only illustrate a few points here because it could get very big, take too much time. And the other thing about this guy is that he ended the talk on the hour last night. 8 o'clock, he stopped talking. Paul Lynn has been trying to do that for 35 years and has failed miserably over and over, to the point where I started one Dharma talk with the following title: I promise not to make any more promises, such as the talk will end at 8. I've shortened my notes. I even thought, let me go all the way down from like 6 pages to 2. Why don't I get more sophisticated and get whatever it's called, an iPad, a thing that you just go like this with. Here's the next page for Steve. Here's the next page for Paul. Come on, Paul, update. Okay, I'll just do my older sister just for a minute, okay? Birth name was Linda. Got married. 2 kids. Looked like it was going well. About 15, 18 years. Looks like it's going well. Finally, a woman calls my sister up on the phone and says, by the way, I've been having an affair with your husband for the last 12 years. Just thought you should know. Ouch. My sister goes through quite a lot. Discovers there's something called psychotherapy, and it's not just something other people do. Discovers that this thing's called antidepressants, and it's not just something other people take. Goes through a lot. Came out the other side of that. Changed her name from Linda to Melinda. Notice the M-E at the front. Doofus here. Can't read. For years, I'm seen as Wee Linda. Wee Linda. Wee Linda. Wee Linda. Wee Linda. Wee Linda. She lets it go on. She lets it go on. She lets it go on. Finally, she says, Paul, I changed my name 8 years ago. Do you know what it is anymore? And I said, I never knew what it was unless you're telling me, you know, what are you telling me here? She said, turn the W over. When you get divorced, it's all about you for a while. Okay, so she's got a, you know, you can, I don't have a lot of time. She's got a way of like treating me like I'm the little brother whose stomach she used to blow on. Against my will. That's why I have intestinal distress now. I'm convinced. Okay? That's the whole cause of the symptoms. No doctor can help me with these symptoms, but I know the cause. But can I deal with the cause? Can I cure the cause? No, that's why I'm here. That's why I came to this place. So she says in the text, I just found this before I came down for the halt of the talk. This is what she wrote. What are you doing for your wife's birthday, which is November 18th, period, in case you forgot? Yes. I love her. I love her. She's so difficult. Little Paul, it's always little bro. Little bro, how are you? And then some ridiculous emoji. Little bro, how are you? It's about 7 years ago. As you may remember, it was it's kind of like sort of epidemic that happened up in the Northeast. There was a big sort of a pneumonia that appeared. Some bad flu, and then there was pneumonia. And the little ones, some of them were getting taken out, and some of the old ones were taken out. Okay, this is the 95th year of my dad's life. Boom, got the pneumonia. It's pretty clear, okay, he doesn't have the immunity to fight this. This is going to be the time for Dad to go. I get up to the hospital, Barnstable, Massachusetts, Cape Cod, if you know it. It's a peninsula hanging off the edge there into the ocean. Pull into the hospital, and it was like beyond the twilight zone. You got people walking around in like suits and masks and everything but gas masks. And then you got people walking around just dressed regular. And some people are sort of protecting themselves, some people aren't. It's very strange. Walk in there, get a look at my dad's face, and without him saying a word, I can see immediately, he's just vibing, get me out of here. He's been in there for like 3 days, got a bunch of holes in his arm, because you know when you go in, they got to do stuff to you. You can't just lie there and rest. Okay, we got to check this, do this, insert that, pull that out, check this again. It goes on, and he's just looking at me without saying a word, and it's like so clear. So I realize, okay, here comes this job. This part of the job is get Dad out of here. Now, how do I do that? I'm looking around and going, okay, anybody here on my side? Anybody, like, gonna help? Can I talk to anybody? Oh, yeah, the Dharma. It's always showing up in so many different ways. Quite unassumingly, this gentleman comes and stands. This is a room with like four other people all suffering in different ways. Here's Dad. This gentleman comes and he just stands there. He wasn't doing like, you know, quite standing pose like we've been doing. You know, he wasn't doing any of that stuff. He just had his arms down or maybe like this, I'm not sure. But it, nice dressed guy. He had like a nice color, you know, like, sleeveless sweater, whatever that thing's called, vest, yeah, there it is, vest, nice, he looks good, kind of dark-skinned, olive-skinned. I look at him, and immediately, I feel more comfortable, I just relax. He makes eye contact with me, just stands there. He looks very professional, in a good way, if you know what I mean. So I just walk up to him and I put out my hand and I said, I'm Paul Lynn, this is my father here. And he says, I'm Dr. So-and-so. How can I help you, he says to me. I was like, that you just melted my heart when you said that. I didn't say that, it was too early. And he just is on it. Now the thing about him, I can't remember his name, is that it felt like he was not in time. Which means it felt like he had all the, if you want to call it, patience in the world. He was not on the clock. He was just completely available and responsive. But he also said at a few points there, I do have to go, I'll be back. It was like beautiful. I have a brother, this is just expanding the family just a little bit. I have a brother, he's close to me in age. We have a very complicated relationship. We've been through a lot of things together. My brother is a very, very beautiful and very, very deep spiritual being with a tremendous amount of complications at the physical, emotional, mental levels. But one of the things he does when he gets around people who are, you say, teaching the Dharma and stuff like that, never me, is he basically is the kind of person who will literally, sometimes I've seen him do it in front of a lot of people, get out of his seat and go up and put his head in the person's lap. He has an ability to embarrass others when actually what should be going on is he should be the first one deeply embarrassed by his behavior and then others maybe as well. Sometimes it's in the name of humor. Sometimes it's the name of incredible devotion. He shows up And when he catches the energy of this Egyptian, it turns out it's this Egyptian doctor, there's no way he's going to get in this guy's lap. But he's basically almost bowing down to the guy. Within about 5 minutes, he's asking the guy, can I have your card just in case I need to call you? Which became a real joke because the guy looked at me and was kind of like, does your brother understand how this works? So this is unfolding. Here's the point. A point. Guy, the Egyptian guy's impeccable. He's absolutely equanimous. He's got all the qualities you could say of the virtuous life going, as far as I can see. I don't know his personality, I don't know his background, I don't know his family, but this is how he's just being in this space, and it doesn't feel pretentious at all. And then comes the beautiful, interesting moment where he decides, I guess, to be a doctor. And so he has his scope around his neck, and he says to me, I'm going to examine your father, okay? And I thought, oh, okay, this will be interesting. So we go over to my dad, and he leans in, and he says, Mr. Lynn, my dad's demented. He's had two strokes. Mr. Lynn, tell me the name of the street where you live. My father, you know, he comes out of this little place that he's been in that might be a big place, right? Because some people look like they're in a little place and they're actually in the vastness. They're in a big place. My dad opens his eyes, looks the guy square in the eye, as if to lift his glasses that he doesn't have on, and says, I don't care about that kind of stuff anymore. Now, olive-skinned Egyptian doctor turns beet red, looks at me, looks at my brother, embarrassed. Oh, is he embarrassed? It's so beautiful. It's so free. It's so spontaneous. My brother and I are just like, this is really cool, man. What we don't recognize until we do is that awareness is love. The simple, very simple, so-called mindfulness, this non-judgmental, no decision, no commentary. Presence, hiding inside ordinary awareness, getting the job done, business, taking care of this, doing that, planning that, remember to call them, gotta do this. Inside that ordinary awareness that lets you function during the day is meditative awareness, which flowers further and further into recognition and realization, particularly as we allow it to and not avoid it. That meditative awareness flowers into nothing short in its own time, unconditional love. And that unconditional love in its own time reveals what's called pure awareness. Pure awareness is the clear recognition of awareness inseparable from phenomena, no I, me, or so-called ownership to the awareness or the experiences that the awareness is aware of. That's called pure awareness, or to use Steve's term, non-dual awareness. Got that? Ordinary awareness, inside ordinary awareness, meditative awareness. Inside meditative awareness, unconditional love, pure awareness. It's already in our own hearts. It's already in our own hearts. We're just allowing the uncovering, the unveiling, so that it can come forth. That's so-called the path. Okay, where's Joni? In the dark back there? Yeah, no? Jamie? Yeah, you back there?
Yes.
Good. This is for you a little bit. So, the classic so-called hindrances They're not just the so-called meditative hindrances. Sometimes they're called defilements. I found that to be a unnecessary term fairly early in my learning of this stuff. Nonetheless, impurity sometimes used. Well, if there's an impurity, then there's got to be a purity. I mean, for me, that's tricky stuff, so I don't play with that too much. But hindrance, okay. Hindrance, yeah, I'll go with that. The classic so-called hindrances: desire, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, and doubt. Have you had any of that this 3 days? Anybody? No hindrances at all? No desire, no aversion, no restlessness, no sleepiness, no doubt. No, I don't have any of that. Yeah. You're lying. Or they may have been very subtle and you missed them. Okay, let's go through it. Desire, wanting what you don't have. Aversion, not wanting what you do have. Restlessness, uneasiness and unsettledness amidst what's happening. Sleepiness, which is sometimes ramped up into what's called sloth and torpor. Very pointed terminology, I find. Falling asleep to varying degrees. That's what that is. Falling asleep to varying degrees. We used to play in the old days with the torpor, and we would say, I had a sitting today, and I was torpified. I was torpified. When my wife and I used to practice formally together, she had a lot of sloth and torpor. I had a lot of desire and aversion. Eventually, I realized that she believed, and she had support of the teachers at that time, that sloth and torpor were a more advanced hindrance. Therefore, I felt competitively way behind, and I was feeling that as I had a lot of desire and aversion, that I was actually really in a bad place, and that is, I was in second place behind my wife, who was ahead of me with her sloth and torpor. It got worse because she started to have hallucinations where there were elephants in her head, and they were moving around, and I said, I don't have any elephants in my head, okay? You're not even interested in psychedelics, and I don't even know how many you've taken. So what's going on here? And I'm just sitting with, I want what I don't have, and I don't want what I do, over and over and over and over and over. And then doubt, okay, which could be considered to be the one that actually is the glue that holds the other ones in motion. They're all in motion, okay? There's no self in the hindrances. Doubt, nagging, uncertainty, and distrust that can hook onto any experience, piggyback, suggesting that what is happening is not to be trusted. Most subtle and pervasive of the bunch. As we were looking at in the small group today, perhaps rooted in fear. Doubt, rooted in fear. Perhaps desire, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, perhaps, check it out, rooted in fear. What's fear rooted in? Ignorance. And as one scientist, a very brilliant, I would say, pox virus specialist, one day in the Dharma setting, we used to do sittings at his house, which was large and accommodating. What is the cause of ignorance, Paul? He says in front of the Dharma group, I think, I don't say, Richard, do not ask me such questions in front of people. I know you don't seem to like me at times. I might remind you of your brother, I'm not sure. I'm attempting to love you with all my cells, and I haven't gotten there yet. Why are you asking me this now? Why don't you pull me aside later and we'll have a little dialogue? It's a good question, though. It's the cause of ignorance. Let's let that one float. So you could say that working through the doubts of the mind actually uproot the other friends. Now I'm changing the language. Hindrances are friends in disguise, and then eventually they're not in disguise. They are friends. From the beginning, right through the middle, through the end. Thank you for waking me up. Now I don't need an alarm clock. So sometimes we start out with these things and it's a problem. And it starts to unfold quickly or not so quickly, and the problem becomes a situation. Oh, a situation of so-called hindrances, friends in disguise. Oh, and then the situation evolves. This is like in my head when I'm meditating. Opportunity. Bang. Saw that over and over and over, and then one day I said, oh yeah, I know what AAA means. It's not American Motor Association. It's acknowledge, accept, appreciate. AAA. AAA. Best motor club there ever was. That's what they'll say. I once asked them when they tried to convince me that the policy was worth renewing. I said, are you better than Allstate? And the guy was like, what are you, a wise guy? He didn't say it, but you could kind of feel it. What are you, a wise guy? I said, just a question. Are you better than Allstate? Because I could switch and they might give me lower price. What about Geico? So we start, don't we? We start. Remember the start? Where was the start? Start of the retreat? Where'd you start? When did you start meditating? When did that start? I remember when I started to meditate, I ended up in an Oriental philosophy class in college. I was a junior in the Oriental philosophy class. Oriental philosophy, ooh, that's cool. I'm gonna sign up for this one. And I'm in there, and there's this guy, and he's teaching Oriental philosophy. Then one day he goes, okay, now, in Buddhism, there is this meditation. It's called insight meditation, sometimes called Vipassana. We're gonna do that now. And he goes on a little bit like that, and he says, okay, close your eyes. So all with this, you know, all like juniors, right? What's the age, like 20, something like that? We're all sitting there, and I didn't look around at other people, I just closed my eyes. And then he yells, and I won't do it. He yells, wake up! I looked up and I was like, this guy's screwed up. But we started meditating, and I went down inside, and I felt my breathing. I never felt it before. I went down, I was like, whoa. It was like there was a world down in there. And then we ended. You know how we ended? He smashed the bell. He had a bell. He smashed it. It went right along with wake up. It was like, what, do you think we're all like numb here? What is this? Here's what happened next. This is the truth. I'm not exaggerating. We finished the class, and I ran up to him. I literally ran up to him. Who's in charge? Not me. I ran up to him, and I ran up, and I said, I want to do more of this right now. And he looked at me, and he said, take it easy. And I repeated myself, I want to do more of this right now. And he said, okay. Like this with his hands, okay. He says, we'll go up to my office, okay? As soon as this is wrapped up here, I got a few more things to do, we'll go up to my office and we can do more of it, okay? I said, okay, I'll wait. Talk to this person, get his stuff, da-da-da-da. We go up to his office. You know what it was? It was a closet almost. It was like a closet. It was like, this is an office? It's a closet. And there was a big, huge, like, air conditioner thing right on the other side over there. And it was making all kinds of noise. And we sat down there and we did the breathing. We start out aiming for something other than where we are or how we are. Slowly or quickly, this trance dissolves and we settle into opening up to what is. And as the practice matures, both in the formal sense and in the so-called informal sense, that means it's extending into living honestly and authentically. Still, the trance of the doer, the one who is mindful, the one who is directing and choosing, suddenly, oh, Steve said, attention. I think I'll attend to what it is he's saying. The one who believes they are here, meditating. The one who thinks they are aware. That trance goes on until it dissolves in awareness, because it dissolves, remember, it dissolves in sleep. Dissolves in awareness. So it's recognized. So life, as you can see with the story with Micah, passing with the cancer, my dad, the Egyptian, all these illustrations from so many different places here, it's coming in all the time. What's happening is so often unabided. Even as we think our choices are that which directs our life. Deep in the cells, deep in the molecules that make up this body-mind in part, our own unique and original templates of conditioning are working, surfacing, and transforming. Working, surfacing, and transforming. When these conditions are met within an atmosphere of communal liberation through living, that's this retreat, liberation through living. These conditions are the very petrol of awakening. There's your so-called hindrance, turning into a friend in disguise, turning right before your eyes into a friend. The very petrol of awakening, the essence, if you will, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, takes us increasingly straight to compassion and wisdom. How could there not be an interface? How would we even know what compassion and wisdom are without the so-called opposite, suffering, unsatisfactoriness? And of course, this template, this notion here, that's surfacing and working and transforming, is in part formulated through our familiar and cultural conditioning. In part. These conditions of the body-mind are unique and original in content, and yet their context is shared by all. We're sharing the same context. Content level, your story is different than mine, you come from a different place, different gender, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, consciousness, mental fabrications. That's what's going on here in the context. This is where it really gets, to me, very interesting. Again, we are all made of the same ingredients, and yet they are combined, shook up, and expressed in beautiful, never to be duplicated by another ways throughout the human and animal kingdoms. Kingdoms. Uniqueness. Nobody is ever you in that deeply, deeply transpersonal, personal sense. You're unique. It's never going to happen again. Everybody in this room looks and acts in a unique and indeed special way, not special above others, special amidst. Everything, everybody's special that way. I decided to try a little, what I hoped would be humor, with one of the staff. I went into my little, in case you haven't noticed me much in the dining hall, it's because I'm afraid to eat with you. No, it's because I can't eat what you're eating as much as I want to. You know how much I want to eat what many of you are eating? I want that very much. It's called desire number one. So they're making me some different stuff. It's kind of boring, but I'm eating it. So I get into my little kitchen on the side over here, and I'm getting ready to eat, and got my plate down, and she comes out. Maybe a little smile, I'm not sure. Says, "You don't mind if I wipe this table, do you?" I said, "Mind? Please. Please wipe the table. Just see how it works. You got to pay attention to the response. Good communication means you have an intention and they impact. And the intention and the impact are close together. Not so good communication, you have an intention, the impact, different. Really different? We're not even on the same page. We didn't even connect. You heard something totally different than what I said. We don't know what's going on here. We're in two different universes, eye to eye." The "yes, please" seemed to work. So I decided to go another step. I said, "Did anybody ever tell you that you're doing a great job?" A little bit of a smile, a little coy, a little shy. No words. So I decided to go step three. You know, my father used to say that to people. I'm looking at guy contact now. My father used to say that to people all the time when I was a little kid. Now the smile's getting a little bigger. My father used to say that to people all the time when I was a little kid. And you know what I thought when I was a little kid listening to all that? How come you're not saying that to me? Now, the second I said that was the punchline, one of the young guys came around the corner. Spontaneous. He said, "What'd you just say to her?"
Oh.
And I said, "Oh, that's cool. Yeah." And I repeated it. We got real close. I repeated it. I said, "Here's the story. My dad used to say this to people, and I thought, why aren't you saying it to me?" And he busted up. And I got him on the way out. You know, there's the departure line. "Thanks for helping me." Now, I have a way that you might notice. I try not to duplicate this too often because nothing can be duplicated. But when something works with one person, I tend to try it with another. You can already see that a little bit there. So then our main cook came in, right? And he had a little extra food for me. I said, "Hey, I'm doing okay. I'm all right. Got enough." He's got his hat on backwards. Little eye contact. I said, "I was talking to your colleagues just before you came through. Can I tell you what I told them?" I went through the same thing. His face hardly changed, hardly budged, didn't laugh. It's like, this isn't going well. And then as he walked away, he said, "I always try to give that compliment to everybody when I can." Could hardly hear him. He was going to the bathroom, but I heard him. Everybody in this room looks and acts in a unique and indeed special way. And yet if we look deep into the eyes of those we sit amidst, we will see the same presence looking out of those eyes that's looking out of these eyes. We will see the same presence, the one awareness shining not only out of the eyes, but in the eyes and behind the eyes. Words can fall away here a bit. Don't matter is the recognition of that which sees all conditions, allows all conditions, and transcends all conditions, simultaneously begins to wake up. So it's not just these conditions coming forth in and through each of us. It's not just these templates. It's also this ground of presence, this awareness, this common to all, this true nature of awake openness that is ultimately inseparable from conditions. strangely free amidst the stainless, immaculate, unchanging, formless, groundless ground. See? That's why awareness has no center and has no circumference, no periphery, because it is the groundless ground. It is what the body is sitting in, not it sitting in the body. Pearl beyond price, as it's described in the Sufi tradition. Sufi is the mystical school of Islam, the school of Rumi, and our guest tonight, Rabia. Rabia will come in a minute. Beyond a guest. This groundless ground is absolutely reliable and faith-inspiring. Insights into it as your own true nature are not only the art and science of meditation, but also simultaneously the culture of awakened living. It's the culture of awakened relatedness. It's the Sangha. And because it's the Sangha, it's the Buddha flowering, it's the Dharma expressing itself, multiplicity of ways. Awakened living right from the get-go shifts the perceptions and ideas about pain, blockages, inhibitions, diseases, and so-called hindrances. It invites the strength and humility of innocence and wonder. I thought of all of you, in a collective way came for me in the parking lot saying goodbye to Chloe and her baby. And I hadn't gotten up close to that little baby for this 3-4 days. And here's my opportunity, and I ain't gonna miss it. He's not just drinking the air. He's breathing the light. He's rolling around. He hasn't quite got the head stabilized. Remember that one? Can't really hold your head up very long. Right. It's available in the sittings. Steve, Paul say, let the body be stable, and your head's going. Hey, what is this hindrance? Desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness? What have I got? So here's a really, come for me, there's like a couple of like, okay, one-liners that's the whole thing, right? Here it is, maybe. Never know for you till it is what is zinger for you. This awakened living helps us see that whatever is coming forth in any situation or circumstance is perfect in the sense that it couldn't be any way other than it is in that moment. Bang. This has nothing to do with the dualism of perfect, imperfect. It had nothing to do with any hierarchy of better, worse, good, bad, etc. It's a perfection that is defined as things are as they are, utterly ordinary and thus extraordinary simultaneously. It takes us ever deep into what it is that this is. And at the same time, over and over, with endless precision, the Dharma of change unfolds. Conditions keep displaying themselves in endless varieties of ways. And if you're a traveling type, which I have been at times in my life, all I want to do is go to different places, do different things, see different people, eat different food. What you realize with the Dharma opening in even just 3-4 days of shared meditation, the whole world's unfolding right here. Greatest show in town. Byproduct of that is if you like movies, you go to the movie. how simple it is that the so-called sense of an I, me, that's embodied in here can fall away. I'm having lunch with my son. He's in grade school 18 or so years ago. We're sitting out there having lunch with the other kids. I'm sitting there having lunch with him. The mind might say, this is due to meditation. This is why this happens. We're just eating lunch. I can't remember what we were eating. We're eating lunch. It's a nice sunny day. And all of a sudden, this whole sense of Paul goes away. The whole story, the whole meanness, the whole center of this, boom, goes away. We're just eating lunch. What am I going to do? Start talking to his friends? Hey, the sense of self just dissolved. By the way, I'm a meditation teacher. I like to talk about the essence of that. The sense of self just dissolved. No. Just eating lunch. It's completely not really ordinary. Some people, it never turns into an emotional thing. It never turns into a big deal because it's just the truth as it is. Wow. Oh. And for some of us, me at times, it becomes a big, dramatic, emotional thing that I have to tell anybody and everybody who will listen. That's called you. This is nothing short of a true awakening. What is happening for the first time and the only time. And yet the characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness born from grasping and clinging and resisting, which reveals an intrinsic unpossessibility, keeps consistently revealing amidst the changing conditions. We all know quite clearly that nothing's possessible. How deeply do we know this? As one teacher said to me, get it from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. Tell me when it's complete. Oh, that ain't good. I appreciate that. Yeah, nothing's possessible. Makes sense, sure. Young children intuit the body-mind will die. Rabia of Basra. I need to read this to you. I didn't wanna need to. Read this to you. I was trying to figure out how not to read this to you, and it couldn't not be done. It wouldn't go away, so I'm going to read it to you. Rabia of Basra is without doubt the most popular and influential of female Islamic saints and a central figure in the Sufi tradition. She was born nearly 500 years before Rumi. And although it is rarely said, she perhaps more than any other poet influenced his writings. If you love Rumi, or if you ever love Rumi, it's important to know this. Rabia grew up in the part of ancient Mesopotamia that is now Iraq. She was the fourth daughter of impoverished parents, and a story connected with her birth tells of the Prophet Muhammad appearing to her father in a dream to tell him that his daughter would be revered as a great saint. When Rabia was quite young, she became separated from her parents. Perhaps they died. And while wandering homeless, she was literally stolen and sold into slavery. Because of her remarkable beauty, a famous brothel bought her for a large sum. It is believed she lived and was forced to work as one might in a brothel for many years. Rabia may be a timely spiritual voice for women of this century, especially for any women or men who have had to suffer the emotional crippling degradation of unwanted touch. She was both physically and sexually abused from an early age, yet still, became one of the greatest women saints and poets known to history. That's why I needed to read it. One poem from Rabia. It's called Die Before You Die. Ironic, but one of the most intimate acts of our body is death. So beautiful appeared my death. Knowing who then I would kiss, I died 1,000 times before I died. Die before you die, said the Prophet Muhammad. Have wings that feared ever touched the sun. I was born when all I once feared I could love. So we recognize over and over that we truly don't really own anything, that ownership's an illusion. And furthermore, if we go into denial of this fact, then suffering increases through the actions of clinging. So the more deeply we can have a glimpse of the no ownership, no possessibility, then in fact the path to true abundance opens. Clinging, grasping, released from the mind stream, quite magically and wonderfully, we begin to see that we're actually connected to everything that's happening. And as we see we own nothing, we strangely find we're part of everything. Not as owners, but as lovers. People used to say sometimes to me and sometimes to those I've trained from, where's the devotion in this? It's pretty dry. And one of the answers to that is, you want devotion? Could you get more devotional than the devotion and love of every instant moment as it is? If you can't see the devotion in that, what are you looking for? Some image? Some projection? Well, if you go there, eventually what it'll do, if it works, is it'll take you back right here to everything. When we truly love, we are simultaneously open and connected to whatever is happening in a way that is startling and fresh. The great allowance of awareness is loving, embracing, allowing. We are unclinging and really, in a way, free-falling, floating, if you will, in the stream of life. Close this talk this way. I'm just a couple minutes over. Vulnerability has two fundamental meanings. One is fragility, and the other is openness. It's in Webster's dictionary. Again, David White. Vulnerability is not weakness. A pausing indisposition or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent of our natural state. To run from vulnerability is to run from the essence of our nature. The attempt to be invulnerable is a vain attempt to become something we are not, and most especially to close ourselves off from understanding of the grief of others. More seriously, in refusing our vulnerability, we refuse the help needed at every turn of our existence and immobilize the essential title and conversational foundations of our identity. Can that guy string some words together? That's David White. As we mature, we inhabit our vulnerability, and we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance as well as appearance, coming and going of life, the birthing and deathing of the moment, We can learn to inhabit our vulnerability as generous citizens of loss robustly and fully. Emptiness is the door to fullness. And then you begin to see, no, it's not a door at all. Emptiness is fullness. The door goes away. Because it was only there in your mind. Let's close the talk with Kabir. Now, Kabir was a very unique poet and powerful spiritual being in the 1400s, 1500s in India. He was born in Varanasi, India. He was able to bridge traditions like nobody in his time. He was able to bridge particularly to the Muslim tradition and the Hindu tradition. He also was able to blend Christianity in ways into this that was absolutely unique. One poem from Kabir. It's called Professional Counseling. Get this. He's a Zen master, no doubt. From the ocean, I heard a million fish say, "Give me a beer. Quick." I replied, "Dears, how can that be? How can a fish in the water want a drink?" "Well, that's how wacky things have gotten. Who else but Maya," that's the Hindu word for illusion, "who else but Maya could pull a fast one like that and get away with it? Seriously speaking, though, the fish in the water that is thirsty needs serious professional counseling." We're in the water, we're in the air, we're in the atmosphere of truth all the time. We come and go from that which we are all the time. It doesn't go away. You come and go from it. Let's sit for just a few minutes.